Welcome to Crawl Space.
Yes, welcome. Hello, I am Tim, here tonight with Lance. Lance, que pasa?
Que pasa, yeah. I love that intro. That gets me fired up every single time. The music, I love thinking about the Dean case and just taking a step back from all the craziness of these current cases. And as the late, great Huey Lewis said, going back in time.
It's a lot of fun to dive into this case. The music kind of brings you back already. And Ed Hoopman's voice is lovely as well. So, tonight we have episode 3 of the Dean murder case, our coverage of that. William K. Dean from the small town of Jaffrey, New Hampshire, was murdered in August of 1918. And this is the third episode in this series. If you haven't heard the first two yet, I do recommend you check those out. But tonight, we are going to introduce you to the Dean Murder Research Group. This audio is from when we filmed with the Dean Murder Research Group up in Jaffrey, New Hampshire in April of 2017.
The Dean Murder Research Group is a group of gentlemen who reside in Jaffrey or in the surrounding towns, Keene, Peterborough, Dublin, and they have gone together, which we talk to them. We have these interviews with them, and we ask them how they got involved with the Dean murder, and that's essentially what brought them together. And they all have their different reasons, and it's really fascinating, especially Rob Stevenson, who organizes the Dean Murder Research Group. You'd think that the organizer would be the most passionate and opinionated about the case, but when we spoke to him, and you'll hear this, he really has no interest in finding out any solution. I think he realizes the type of rabbit hole that you can get caught up in. And he says, I have other interests. And we'll hear this later on. But he does a really, really excellent job. I think that's important because to not be so personally connected to it, so that he can scan and upload the thousands and thousands of pages of FBI documents. He can organize the meetings. He can maybe bring some coffee to the meetings, but and get lunch and everything. But very, very interesting and diverse group of people. The age group goes from 30 years old to, at least the 90.
So our first clip tonight we have is just introducing a few of these members, five of these members. One of them you've heard before, Ryan. And then we're going to be back to explain what the next clips are.
Ryan, I believe, is one of the, unless I'm completely wrong, one of the youngest people in the Dean Murder Research Group. And over the course of his research, he's amassed a ridiculous amount of information. And he's got a filing cabinet in his brain that he can just pull from. Very interesting person. And he is the first person that we interviewed when we went up there in April. And just ask some pretty direct questions.
My name is Ryan Malahi.
Why do you look into the case?
Actually, I'm a researcher, and I was at the Keene Library doing unrelated research on the history of movie theaters, and I was in the vertical file. And I came across a file that said Dean murder. And so, being a CSI, junkie and mystery, I delved into that file, and it had some basic clippings on the Dean murder and Mr. Dean, and it just really titillated me. And so I went home and started doing some web research, and I saw that there was a murder group that was forming to do research. And being a local researcher, I was fascinated, and I came down and met with the group and got involved.
What is your name?
Greg Burke.
And why do you look into this case?
Well, about 10 years ago, I was on vacation up here, staying in a B&B right here in Jaffrey. And at breakfast, I ran into a fellow who had returned Jaffrey for his 50th high school reunion, and he was talking about this case, and I got interested, and so I found the grand jury proceedings that Mark Schmuller put together, and really was fascinated by the whole question. Came up, I met Mark's mother back then. She had given a presentation over at Peterborough one time. And over the course of, since then, it's probably 10 years, I've been working, trying to decipher some sense out of all the data. Been looking at the records from FBI, been down to the National Archives, gotten a lot of additional records, like from the Army, and have done a lot of reading and investigation about aspects of the case that are not necessarily included in the records here, involving the German connection, looking at the history of the German espionage and sabotage in the United States, both before World War I, our entry into World War I, and during the war, which is quite fascinating. It was quite active and extensive. And I'm trying to bring the connections into Jaffrey via an external review of what was going on in the German espionage space to try to develop this theory that the murder was related, in fact, to Mr. Dean finding out about the signaling.
I'm Mark Bean. I got interested in the case because I grew up in Jaffrey. My family is from Jaffrey. My grandfather, Delcy David Bean Sr., who was the founder of D.D. Bean & Sons Company, my family's business, was involved in the case at the time. He was a young businessman, Bean & Simons was the name of his business at the time, and he was very much involved, knew the characters, knew Rich, and Dean also. And then years later, my mother was the one that transcribed the grand jury inquest, the notes that were discovered at the Keene courthouse, and she had been trained in Pittman shorthand, and so she volunteered to do that. And so I've always had a connection to and an interest in the case.
I'm Richard Boutwell. I am a native of Jaffrey. Well, I initially got involved because I volunteer with the archives of the Jaffrey Historical Society. And when the group first formed, they wanted to know what we had in the archives. So I was the one involved with getting everything together. And of course, I had, having grown up in town, became curious because all the years I'd lived here, I'd never heard of the case. And so I began becoming quite curious. So I began reading as much of the materials as I could find and sort of was captured by it and captivated by it and wanted to know more. And after the group really got going, much more came forward. So I've just been sort of following along.
It's Rob Stevenson. Yeah.
And why do you look into this case?
Well, I'm no longer, but I was president of the Historical Society when we received a grant, actually two grants, to do something to acknowledge or bring attention to the 100th anniversary of the Dean murder. So as I was president at that time, I figured I have to do something. So I am not indeed, in fact, I've tried very hard not to become too engrossed in the whole story because I've got other things I'm engrossed in. And so I leave that to others, but I've been doing a lot of the organizing developing a website and scanning documents and so forth. But my knowledge of the whole thing is not as deep as that of several other people involved in this. I've scanned all these documents and I've never read the results, which is fine with me.
Which is fine with Rob Stevenson. I love it. Rob doesn't want to know. I think it's different. It's unique. It's special to groups like this. And I think it's important. Like you were saying, you need someone like this who will keep their emotion out of it and will do the work that is required to get the information out there. And then, you know, let other people kind of play with that information and get emotional with it.
Right. Exactly. Isn't it super interesting that it takes 100 years? For something that absolutely polarized a town, absolutely divided a town, to create this sort of, I mean, during their discussions, they, you know, there were a couple of small heated moments, but when I say heated, it's only heated in comparison to the really casual conversation that they were having before. And there were just sort of disagreements with details, but all of them have very simple reasons for being involved. And Rob's reason is that he was president of the Historical Society, and this the 100-year anniversary is coming up. It was a very significant time in the town's history, and that's coming up, and they're hopefully going to be opening up a new theater. They're hopefully going to have a play that is commemorating the 100-year anniversary based on the Dean murder, and the spectrum is so huge for everybody's reasons, but the reasons themselves are super simple. It's a really cool group of people that we just heard from. We heard from Greg Burke, who was someone who vacationed in the Jaffrey area and didn't have a direct connection, but he started looking into it. He said it immediately struck him. And I don't think what immediately struck him was what turned out to be his reasons for becoming fascinated with it. Because what immediately strikes you is how, I guess, gruesome the murder itself is, and it's unsolved, and wow, it's unsolved to this day. And then once you start looking into it, and he says this too, he basically starts dissecting like society in small town America during the first Great War. And Jaffrey was certainly a small town, and the first Great War affected every town in America. And look at how it affected this town. And I think he got really caught up in that. And looking at how the impact, even on the small town in the middle of New England, gets caught up in something like that.
I also think for Greg, it kind of sounded like almost like the beginning of a horror movie or something like that, where he's on vacation at a bed and breakfast, and he's reading the morning paper, having coffee at this bed and breakfast. Then he hears someone come in and starts talking about the murder, and then he overhears it, and then he gets really curious about it, and then starts looking into it. I mean, it's a great setup.
Oh yeah, political thriller horror. Yeah,
yeah,
totally. Like Dan Brown wrote it.
But he, I think his angle is interesting because he is still digging for a connection that proves that the feds were up there investigating these specific lights and at that specific time. So I think that's pretty interesting. He's kind of taking a different angle and looking to sort of a roundabout way of proving that Mr. Dean was killed because of these lights.
Exactly. And what we do know is that the federal agents were there in the months and weeks before the murder, including the day of, and they were looking into claims of lights on Mount Monadnock and the surrounding mountains. And what you're saying, and what's very cool, is that Greg's angle is that he wants to make the connection that those lights and the reasons that the federal agents were there was because of espionage, whether it's German espionage or some other espionage related to the war. There was some sort of unpatriotic espionage, which is probably redundant.
Right. Yeah, I think you're right, though. If it can be proven that these federal agents were in Jaffrey investigating these lights and Mr. Dean gets killed that night, you know, and obviously everything he was talking about leading up to his murder was these lights. Yeah, I mean, it's too coincidental not to be part of the reason why he was killed.
Exactly. And then you fit the pieces together with Charles Rich and the black eye, and you include Ryan's theories, and there's a lot of moving parts to this, a lot of elements, a lot of characters that we haven't even gotten into that can contribute to this.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Now, Richard Boutwell, who I believe is the oldest of the group, he told us some stories that are sort of off the record when the last time we were up there in December about some students of his, and got really animated when he was telling these stories. So as simple as his reason is for becoming involved with the Dean murder, he's almost the most appropriate person to discuss it, just based on how where he was at when he was super young, and this is he was feeling the residual effects of the town, the aftermath of it. He can speak to how people reacted to it, how his family reacted to it, and you know he was in charge of the archives at the Historical Society. He was able, I mean, I'm sure the things that he looked at and touched were things that he had looked at and touched when he was a kid, and you know, newspaper articles or you know, just artifacts. I mean, he's the closest you can get to a direct doorway to that time, which is awesome. Mark Bean also is a pretty direct doorway to that time, with his mother transcribing the Pittman shorthand for the grand jury hearing, which, if you don't know, look up Pittman shorthand. It's basically lines and kind of chicken scratch.
Yeah, we posted a picture a while ago on our Instagram and Facebook page of it. And yeah, it just looks like almost like a doctor's handwriting.
exactly.
But there's no letters. It's just scribbles. So it's pretty amazing that she was trained in transcribing Pittman's shorthand for an unrelated reason many years before. And it came in handy in this way, which was pretty cool.
Right. And Mark is now the torchbearer, whether he likes it or not. It was his mother. It was his mother, and it was her work. And he doesn't seem like he is shying away from it at all.
No.
But, I mean, he does run a company, and he does have other involvements and responsibilities. But he's a cool dude. Like, he has talked to us a lot, and he's very, very specific about where he stands with this. And yeah, he is sort of the torchbearer for this.
Okay, and the next clip is these fellows talking about what the strangest thing about this case is.
I think the strangest thing about the mystery is that the town was very it's tough to say. Yeah, give me a sec here.
Oh, sure.
I guess the strangest thing about it is just having grown up in Northern Mass near Jaffrey, and you know, knowing about Jaffrey and Monadnock my whole life, I never would have dreamed that there was German spy activity and you know all of the things that I've learned that were going on at the time in Jaffrey. You know, I never would have thought in a million years that sort of thing was happening right in my backyard, you know, about 100 years ago. So that to me was probably the most strange and fascinating thing, finding out that this story that, you know, is like a combination of Twin Peaks, The X-Files, and Indiana Jones is, you know, going on right in your backyard.
The strangest thing I find about the mystery is the incompetent initial investigation. It was done so poorly that it's really hard to believe that even 100 years ago that the standards for investigatory and forensics were so bad.
I guess it's the way that it divided the town so much that it became such an issue between the different classes, the Catholics and the Protestants, and the mill owners, the industrialists in town versus the working families. And that, you know, a murder like this was so unusual to happen in Jaffrey, and the effects that it had on the town were so significant and lasted for so long. That's always been an amazing thing to me.
I think just all the elements that there are there. I mean, there's the rich versus poor, Protestant versus Catholic, German lights on the mountain, mysterious characters. You know, it just seems like it has all the elements for a real mystery, which it is.
Okay, so another pretty good clip here. My first takeaway is the social elements, how they kept coming up. I mean, I think that's interesting. More than one person mentioned it. Rich versus poor. Protestant versus Catholic. And that was the first time that I had heard rich versus poor. So what do you make of that? Does that mean that the Dean and his wife weren't like as wealthy as Charles Rich?
No, because I think at least Mrs. Dean had a background that afforded them the lifestyle for Mr. Dean to be a gentleman farmer, which is a farmer just by choice. He did it for pleasure. They didn't have to go out and get work. But I think the rich versus poor is the fact that, ironically, Charles Rich's position was the president of the bank in town. And all of the, I think it's more about the aftermath. So it's all of the elements that came in and all of the factors that came up after the murder. You have the murder of somebody who is, for lack of a better term, living off of his wife's wealth, and he can afford the lifestyle of being a gentleman farmer. You have one of the main suspects being the president of the bank at the time. You have the people who lived on Dean's farm, very wealthy, Lawrence Kofelt, who didn't even need to get a job, but he went to go get a job at the Portsmouth docks just to show that he – just to basically avoid going to fight the war. It was either work or fight. And then you had this whole element – so it also goes into Catholic and Protestant. You have a real blue-collar working element watching the white-collar element sort of ripping their town apart by doing this, by committing this act, and they have to now deal with the repercussions. So maybe that's where the rich versus the poor comes into play.
I also think it was interesting that Greg mentioned that the investigation was flawed from the very beginning. And as we kind of know from hearing more about this case, it surely was. And so I think some of the reasons why become a little bit more prevalent in the next clips. But before we throw it to that, Lance, do you have anything else about this last clip?
Everybody we spoke to had a reason. Ryan's reason seemed to be a personal fulfillment for a mystery. He even brought up the X-Files in Twin Peaks. He likes that idea of solving a mystery. Greg's reason, which I think we are not surprised at just hearing the first few words that he says, is that it's a botched case. He says they did a terrible job from the beginning. So that's relatable. You know, we can understand that whole concept of people looking into a mystery, and then because it's unsolved, does that just mean that the police botched it because it's unsolved, or did they do a good job and it was unsolved? And then Mark, whose whole family is embedded in that town, his first thing was that it divided the town, and you can get why he would say that. His family brought the town to what it is. You know, it helped the town grow. And then Rob, with his, again, not surprisingly, with his nonchalant attitude of, you know, I don't really, if it's solved, it's solved. If not, it's not. I'm more of the bookkeeper. He says all elements to the case are so he's very general in it. So you've got the one encompassing general guy, and then you have the conspirator, and then you have the personal, you know, fulfillment guy, and then you have the, you know, steeped in family history guy, which I think makes for just an amazing story.
Okay, here's the next clip where these gentlemen describe what they believe happened to Mr. Dean that night.
It's tough, you know, where I'm still in the process of researching it. You know, you can go one day you think one thing, one day next. You know, my core theory at the moment is that Mr. Dean was murdered to be kept quiet by Lawrence Kofelt, possibly his henchman Frank Romano, and Mr. Rich was also somehow involved in that. With just the motives and the circumstances, the people that had a motive to kill Mr. Dean would have been Kofelt, who Mr. Dean threw out of the house from renting his house because he suspected he was a spy. His handyman Frank Romano had run-ins with Mr. Dean and had made threatening comments about him in front of other people. And with Mr. Rich turning up with the black eye and giving different stories as to how he got it, and immediately trying to sell the suicide or Mrs. Dean committing the murder, you know, all of those things lead me to believe that Mr. Rich was somehow involved. He may not have committed the murder. But he was somehow involved in that. Frank Romano and Lawrence Kohlfeldt wanted Mr. Dean dead to keep him quiet.
The group has got several different theories, and the one that I'm working on now is to try to look at additional information that we may get from this particular series in terms of adding new information. When one looks at the documentation that we have now, one finds it's full of inconsistencies, contradictions by different witnesses, and it's virtually impossible to really be certain what's going on. You can develop a lot of theories about what's happened, but there's no smoking gun, as it were, and no definitive evidence with regard to what happened. I have some very strong suspicions about who was involved, but I can't prove it at this point in time. What I'm working on mostly right now is the trying to determine objective evidence of the connection between the German espionage network in the United States and Jaffrey at the time.
Well, he certainly was murdered. There's no question about that. And the idea that, I had grown up thinking that, as I mentioned earlier, that the German spy thing seemed like it was more a product of war hysteria. And lights from Monadnock, you know, signals to Boston always seemed kind of ridiculous to me and unlikely. But the more research that has been done, and there's been more connections to potential of German spy activity in the area, and the fact the way Dean was murdered, this wasn't something that was just... It was a very professional kind of a murder, certainly a very brutal one. And the idea that there had to be something bigger going on seems more and more likely the more I've gotten into it. But I don't have a claim to know what the answer is by any stretch.
Easy question.
Well, I have to believe some of the things that I've heard, the fact that Dr. Dean was in town that night, people saw him and recognized that, him because he was a good citizen of the town, and that he did visit some people and went home, carried out his usual chores, and met his death there. But the circumstances are very curious how that could happen. Of course, the town was much quieter than 100 years ago, but it was just a curious thing to know that why a man who seemed to be as peaceful as he was would be murdered in the brutal way that he was.
It's something I haven't given much thought to, really. I mean, somebody's found all tied up and dead in a well, so he ended up there, and so I would say it's somebody that has already been investigated or known about, you know, be it Rich or Romano or any number of people that one of them is the person who did it. And I mean, I have the feeling it's one person, not two or more, and that it's somebody that we know the name of already, not somebody who, some mystery person that happened to be in the neighborhood and then disappeared.
Okay, some interesting clips there. First thing that comes to mind is Frank Romano from Ryan, and also mentioned again by Rob. I think that's interesting. He's a person we have not heard from or heard about yet in this series. And he's described as Kohlfeldt's handyman or henchman. So that's pretty interesting. And we are going to play a clip from the meeting in just a little bit that dives a little deeper into this guy, Romano.
It depends on who you talk to. Actually, I think Ryan makes it a point to say when he speaks of Frank Romano, he says Kohlfeldt's handyman, his henchman. He always makes sure there's a very clear distinction between being a handyman and a henchman, right? A handyman is a guy who hangs around and fixes things around the property, and a henchman is somebody who does your bidding. So it could be that, without directly saying, that Frank Romano's, you know, quote unquote, job was to be a handyman, but he was actually the henchman. And the more we hear about Frank Romano, he becomes one of the top maybe three or four characters in this case of the most interesting that we can look at. But I also love how these characters are becoming their own characters without realizing it. And I love the way Mark said he certainly was murdered.
Yeah, Mark's comments interested me greatly because he said that he always thought that the signal lights from Mount Monadnock seemed unlikely until he dug very, very deep into this and kind of joined the murder research group and kind of came around to it. But that's kind of similar to my feelings on this. And Lance, you and I have talked about this, and I've texted you just randomly out of the blue before, just saying there's no way there were spy signals going from Mount Monadnock. And you've kind of talked me down off that ledge a little bit. And so I can kind of see that. I don't know that I'm to where Mark is right now, but I'm somewhere in that process, I think.
Yeah, because I love the way Mark said that he started off with that mindset. Mark Bean has every right or every reason to stick to a very simple murder, something that's not going to disrupt this town for many reasons. He has businesses in this town. He has family roots in this town. But for him to say, as he looked at it and it became more apparent, the key words that he used is something bigger was happening. And you can't say, just based on how Dr. Dean was found and the federal agents being involved during World War I, before the murder, the day of the murder, and after the murder, and many people saying that they saw these weird lights coming off of the mountain and the mountains in that area. You have to say that at least something bigger was going on. Not saying German spies, not saying anything specific, but the murder, the lights, the federal agents, there is a bigger thing there. They're not all separate.
Okay, and now for this clip, we have Ryan and Mark talking about if they think that this case will ever be solved.
You know, I think at this point, I think the only way that it will be solved is if someone comes forward with a diary, a letter, a piece of information, or comes forward with a personal account from a relative confessing, you know, I think that's really the only thing at this point that can crack it open, or some document that wasn't released prior being declassified that can be obtained through an FOIA, as far as the military documents that touch on the Dean murder. I think that's really the only way that we'll get an answer on this.
I don't think that we're ever gonna find the smoking gun, the proverbial smoking gun, to say this is exactly what happened. But I think it's likely at this point that we will have a theory of what was, you know, of the things that didn't happen, we can eliminate and end up with a theory of what was pretty likely to have happened, even though we may not have, like I said, hard evidence that would point to an individual. I think we could likely have a theory that makes sense. I'd love to think that we might, but I don't know that that would be possible. If it never gets any more resolved than it is right now, all of this information about what was going on in Jaffrey, looking at it from the perspective of the different religions, the socioeconomic issues, the idea of not only the local town, but the region and even the country during wartime, all of these things are fascinating historical pieces of information that create an extremely interesting story.
Okay, so what do you make of that clip, Lance?
I love the two almost polar opposite. You have Ryan, who's like very optimistic. You can hear it in his voice. It is, and I don't blame him. It is cool. I know that he wants to find that letter or that document or that thing that he can get from the Freedom of Information Act. That's going to be the smoking gun, which is the direct link to Mark saying, I don't believe there's going to be a smoking gun, but I think there's going to be a time when we kind of know, without really knowing or saying what happened, just based on the things that we know didn't happen. that whole, you know, strip away everything that you can, and what you're left with is going to be the truth. But he has a very realistic view about it, and the realistic view is probably the case. You know, I don't think we're ever going to know unless you get Ryan's, unless what Ryan has, his optimism, his idealistic view of the whole thing actually comes to fruition. If there is something that can be pulled out of this safe in a lockbox and it says, "I killed Dr. Dean," you know, with a signature and fingerprints on it. And I don't blame him, but I love the fact that yin and yang are working together.
Okay, cool. And now we get into the group discussion. And the first clip we play here is some conjecture about, did Mr. Dean stop by Mr. Rich's place that fateful night before he was murdered? And who's there to say that he did anyway? And should they be trusted?
The night that Dean was murdered, he allegedly stopped at the Rich House, and he was friends with them. He stopped there, and then he traveled by himself back to his farm. And the Rich House is still, it's right out that window.
What time did he stop at the Rich House?
It would have been
9:30.
What was that?
9:30?
Yeah, somewhere in that.
Now, according to who did he stop at the Rich House?
According to the Rich family, it was Mr. and Mrs. Rich, and it was their Mrs. Rich's sister, Georgiana Hodgkins, who went on to write a book about the Dean murder that the Jaffrey Historical Society published, not until like the 1990s sometime, but... he was friends with, he was very close friends with the Rich family, with Mr. Rich, and had stopped by after doing some shopping in downtown that Tuesday evening and visited with them for a while, and then he went back to his house. And the key thing about that moment was that Rich became a suspect primarily because he had a huge black eye, which he claimed his horse had kicked him. Or had kicked and had knocked his pipe or something back into his face and given him this black eye. The only witnesses to verify that would have been his wife and his sister-in-law, Georgiana Hodgkins, and Dr. Dean, had he survived, that the accident had actually happened prior to Dr. Dean turning up missing.
And there's some additional features with regard to the record. There are other folks that counter the theory that Dean went to Rich's house and that he may have gone straight home. There are some other people who saw Rich and did not see the black eye.
Right.
So there's conflicting evidence about where people were and when.
Well, I thought according to
Georgiana.
I'm reading her book that he came by in the afternoon or... So 9:30 seems really late.
It was in the evening.
It was in the evening.
She had just arrived in Jaffrey, and she went downtown and saw him downtown, and then he traveled back to there. In fact, I guess he gave her a ride in his carriage.
There were two night openings, Saturday and Tuesday night, so the store stayed open until 9 o'clock.
The thing is, though, that, you know, with Georgiana being the sister of Mr. Rich... there's a little bit of bias there, there was numerous witnesses that said Mr. Dean left downtown and went directly back to his house, and then there was other witnesses that said that he stopped at Mr. Rich, so it's pretty divided.
Okay, so a great clip here, Lance. Did Mr. Dean go home first, or did he go to the Rich's place before he went home? And if he had stopped at the Rich's place first, he would have, by Charles Rich's own words, he would have seen Mr. Rich with the black eye from the horse already. meaning that it couldn't have happened during some altercation in which Mr. Dean ended up dead. So you can see why this is kind of confusing, and you can also see why these people have a reason to lie.
Okay, yeah, so break that down into a couple of parts there.
Please.
If we know by the grand jury accounts that Charles Rich, Georgiana Hodgkins, and Lana Rich, Charles Rich's wife, they all have given sworn statements to the effect of Mr. Dean showed up right after Charles was kicked a glancing blow to his face. It hit his pipe, and that in turn hit his face. He got the black eye. Charles Rich has given testimony saying he was sort of putting a cold compress on that eye while Dr. Dean had arrived. So Dr. Dean arrives. He was in the process of doing this cold compress on his eye. And then Dean, according to Georgiana Hodgkins, Dean and Hodgkins had a private conversation, mostly and strangely enough, about existence. About she seemed like she wanted to say that he seemed a little bit detached. So according to the Rich clan, that meeting did happen. Dean was there. The accounts of him not having the black eye, that's the other part to this. So according to the testimonies, 9:30 was roughly the time that he stopped by the house. You know, people didn't have their cell phones and checking times and, you know, knowing what time they texted somebody. So you can say 9:30 is probably 9:30-ish. They have a conversation. And those accounts, now we're into the second part of this, those accounts of after 9:30, probably after 9:40 or 9:45 is when Dean, that's probably the earliest, right, that Dean would have left there. And then someone had seen Charles Rich after that period of time and said he did not have that black eye.
Right.
So that's pretty interesting, and that's where we're at now with the murder research group, their discussion. What we do know is that Charles Rich had a black eye described as a beautiful black eye the next morning.
And one of the members actually in a clip, it must have been right beyond the clip that we pulled, but he said that this was a calm horse, otherwise known as a docile horse, one who never kicked, did not have a history of kicking or anything like that, especially kicking his owner. This whole thing with this book, Prime Suspect, Prominent Citizen, this is the book by Georgiana Hodgkins, the sister-in-law of the prime suspect. It almost feels like a tabloid, to be honest, and I don't mean to offend anybody, and I know the Jaffrey Historical Society published this book in the 90s. I don't think they published it as this is a historical truth, this is a historical fact. This is more of like an artifact from the history of this town, I think is kind of how they published it. But you said just a minute ago, Lance, that Georgiana, the author of the book, had this conversation about life with Dr. Dean right before he died. And the only one who could back that up is Dr. Dean.
And we get into it with Ryan, because Ryan was the first person to bring up to the Dean Murder Research Group that this book was basically fiction. And it is a bit tabloid in the way it reads. It's been extremely hard. We know that Jack Cooey wrote Two-Legged Foxes, and my interactions with him while he was trying to get that published was that it was very tough to get that book published. The only other book dedicated to the Dean murder is The Dean Murder Mystery by Burt Ford that was published in 1920. And that was also sort of self-published. And it was almost done as a Burt Ford was a war correspondent. He was a journalist. So it was almost a collection of his findings. So you have a book in 1920. You have a tabloidish type book in 1990-ish by Georgiana Hodgkins. And then you have Jack Cooey's book, Two-Legged Foxes, which is also it's categorized as fiction because he's very specific in his theories with the Masonic Temple and the German spies and who he thinks is responsible for it. You'd think that something that had this much gravity, especially right during the time when books were huge. It wasn't like someone was going to make a movie out of this. Like there, I would have felt that there should have been several books just coming out. There's war drama. There's espionage. There's this murder that is, you know, he's thrown in a well and strangled, and the president of the Monadnock Bank, and crazy. It begs for a book.
Yeah, and she could have been paid to write this book by Rich. You know, if it's a lie, then all three of them were in on this. It was a secret that they all knew, that Charles Rich now had to bring these two, his wife and his wife's sister, in on this murder plot that he apparently had no way to get out of if this is what happened, because how could he just say, yeah, I did it in cold blood? You know, they probably would have... They wouldn't have written this book. You know, this book wouldn't have been written the way it likely was. Maybe the wife would have divorced him. Who knows, you know, if he just admitted to a murder. But if he comes to them and says, well, look, I had no choice. This is what happened. This is the situation. These Germans and blah, blah, blah. And then you get these people who conspire and write a whole fucking book about how he's innocent and call the book Prime Suspect, Prominent Citizen.
Right. When I first saw that book years ago, and I actually bought it at a small bookstore in Peterborough, New Hampshire, I thought that it was going to be about, because the title's even misleading. It's called Prime Suspect, Prominent Citizen. You think that it's about this, like, the takedown of this guilty man who is a prominent citizen in the town. He's a prime suspect, prominent citizen, used his power to do this, you know, this deed. And then as you start to read it, you definitely realize that this is definitely a very sympathetic book towards Charles Rich. And what you're talking about is that bigger picture that Mark Bean brought up in the earlier interview there. If Charles Rich had something to do with it and he got the black eye in the struggle during Dean's murder, then that means that you have Charles Rich, his wife, his sister-in-law, you have the people that contributed to Dean's murder. So at the very least, it was Charles Rich and one more, because Charles Rich is not driving the murder car, murdering somebody, coming back. Like,
so you're talking at least four or five people that
you're talking. Yeah, you're talking at least two people that murdered Dean, and then at least three people who Charles Rich, if this is the case, told. And now it's this bigger picture that you just kind of can't ignore. And it really does fall. One part of it falls on the black eye. When did the black eye happen?
Sure. I think this is all I need to know about Charles Rich. He showed up at the murder scene, and before he even saw the body, he said it was suicide. And then when they said, no, actually, sorry, buddy, we've seen the body. There's no fucking way, you know, Mr. Dean killed himself the way the body was found. And then he said, oh, well, Mrs. Dean did it. And meanwhile, Mrs. Dean is suffering a deterioration of her mental capacities and physically unable to kill her husband and drag him the 100 feet necessary uphill to throw him in the rain cistern. So to me, that tells me it's pretty effing obvious that this guy had motive to lie.
I'm pretty sure that is the words that was used when he showed up at Dean's property, too. After he said that it was suicide, I'm pretty sure Picard went up to him and was like, dude, there's no fucking way that it was suicide. But you're right. Him immediately attributing suicide to this, him also showing up with before. That's the other key to the whole Charles Rich thing, is who made the phone call and when. Well, we do know who made the phone call to him. He shouldn't have known when he showed up in the first place that Dean was dead. According to all accounts, he showed up believing that Dean was just missing at the time.
Meanwhile, he showed up with the town undertaker.
Yeah, yeah, the town undertaker, the coroner. Because that's who you usually call up when you have a limited amount of people to call up. I'm just being sarcastic, but I could be totally wrong. Maybe that is something that you do, or something that you did back then. You know, your friend's missing, you just saw him the night before, and I guess maybe you do call up the coroner and say, hey, just in case we find the body, let's go up there.
Right. Now, on the flip side of this, just to be as objective as we can, right? So taking Georgiana Hodgkins's word for it, and her and Dr. Dean, Mr. Dean, did have a conversation about life and how right before he died, she tells Mr. Rich about that conversation. They hear there's an accident. Maybe she suspected he sounded suicidal or something like that. I mean, I know they're friends, and maybe if she had said that to him, he would have went over there and checked logically, but maybe she didn't mention it until the next morning.
Very, very reasonable, right? So they have this deep conversation, and next morning all she knows is that the phone call's been received and Dean's missing. And she might say, he sounded really existential last night, and might, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if he would have done something. He was depressed about Polly. You know, he was depressed about his wife. He might have done something. But again, like, to show up and just immediately say, well, he's killed himself. And also to circle back on the Undertaker, it's mentioned in the grand jury testimony, and it's very evident that there is a divide between Catholics and Protestants when Charles Rich is asked about the Undertaker. And there were two primary Undertakers in the town, funeral homes Undertakers. It was Knoyer and Layton, and he showed up with Layton. And he mentions in the grand jury, Knoyer is a Catholic and Layton is a, is not. So if you read deep in between the lines there, you can see where there's already a wedge that's being placed, whether it's intentional or not. But again, the key is, what happened at the house? What did he tell Georgiana Hodgkins? And when did that black eye happen?
And here is the last clip that we have here for this episode. And we're talking about one of the new suspects, Frank Romano.
On the Kofeld theory, there's, you know, another big theory which kind of doesn't get mentioned a lot, but was one that he was one of the main suspects at the time, was Frank Romano, who was Kofeld's assistant or all-around man, basically his handyman. And if you, now you don't see a lot mentioned about him, there's a bit mentioned about him in the grand jury hearing. There's a statement that Pickard read from him, but if you go through the FBI documents and the interviews and things of that nature, he was one of the main people suspected by people after Kofeld, because he was Kofeld's kind of henchman, and he had made threatening statements allegedly about Mr. Dean, and they had a whole problem because when Kofeld moved in, Mr. Dean didn't want him using his barn for his animals, but Kofeld kind of muscled his way into Mr. Dean's barn. Now, Romano, being his caretaker, would be out there caring for Kofeld's things in Mr. Dean's barn. Now, Mr. Dean didn't like that, and this developed to be kind of a problem between Mr. Dean and Romano. So there are people that heard Romano say they would find Mr. Dean hanging, which is pretty incriminating. He left the employ of Mr. Kofeld not long before the murder took place, and he wasn't able to account for where he was during the 3 days where the murder took place, Romano. And almost everybody interviewed about him had not a good notion about him, that he was kind of a sketchy individual. So Romano was somebody who is a very big suspect because he could not account for his whereabouts. He was Kofeld's kind of henchman or almost bodyguard type guy, if you will. Initially, they ruled him out after their interviews, but if you go back and really go through the data now with fresh eyes, there's a lot of reason to believe that he was involved with the murder.
Why was he ruled out?
Well,
he had an alibi.
Well,
but it was a sketchy alibi.
Yeah, I mean, okay. He didn't really have an alibi. I mean, he said that he was in Silver Lake, New York, with a woman who he didn't remember her name that he had met. And he also said he was sleeping out in the woods. So he was very vague about where he was at that time. And so, like I said, he had made threats. There was the issue with Mr. Dean with the barn, which gave... And that was a conflict that was known to people that knew Mr. Dean. And so I think that they just interviewed him and they really, you know, they couldn't prove where he was or if he was at Mr. Dean's, so they kind of, you know, they kind of had to leave it be. But there's a lot of things in the documents that kind of contradict. He tried to come off as very nice and, oh, I would never do that, and that he didn't know anything about Kohfeldt's possible German activities, but at the same time, he admitted, you know, he told people they would rake the driveway every night in Temple, so if someone showed up on a horse at night, they could tell that people had been there. So, you know, on the same token, he's talking about doing things to keep track if people are coming to the property. So there's a lot of mixed signals, and the biggest damning thing for me was that they interviewed Romano's landlord back in New York after he'd gone back right after the murder, and his landlord said that Romano hadn't been eating, he was acting weird, he wasn't sleeping, and the landlord of the rooming house was so suspicious that Romano was involved that he actually threw him out of the boarding house, asked him to leave. So, you know, so I think Frank Romano, you know, he's almost a package deal almost with Kohfeldt in a way that, you know, there's a good chance that he could have either done the murder for Kohfeldt or been present, and he definitely had, you know, a motive because he didn't like Mr. Dean's.
Romano with the threatening comments, his landlord kicking him out, not having a good alibi. What does this all mean, Lance?
Romano was described by Kohfeldt to be an all-around guy, somebody that he can't just pay someone, you know, a certain amount per week to just do what he needed to be done. He from all accounts, he enjoyed working with Romano, and Romano enjoyed working with him. He left his employ at the beginning of August during the year of the murder. And every time we talk about Romano, it always reminds me of the character from The Godfather. Was it Luca Brasi? He's a guy who will pledge his allegiance to you no matter what. And I think whether or not there was a murder that had happened, I feel like Romano had always pledged his allegiance to Kohfeldt because Kohfeldt appreciated the fact that he could do anything that he asked him to do. The accounts of him not being able to eat or sleep, very interesting stuff, which we'll get into a little later on. But yeah, Romano is one of those characters, and it's definitely true that Dean and Romano had very conflicting views about what was to happen on the property and who had rights to do what.
Okay, that's it for this episode of Crawl Space. Follow us on Twitter at Crawl Space Pod. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll be back soon with more Dean murder. When a person goes missing, their loved ones often find themselves overcome with worry and grief. Bruce Maitland started the 501c3 nonprofit organization Private Investigations for the Missing because he knows this feeling all too well.
When Bruce's daughter Brianna disappeared in March 2004, he was surrounded by licensed private investigators dedicated to finding her. Now his mission is to provide dedicated private investigators at no cost to other families of the missing, desperate for answers but without the financial means.
Private Investigations for the Missing needs your help. To read the mission statement, make a donation, and keep up with our blog, visit us at investigationsforthemissing.org and follow us at PI for the Missing on Twitter and Facebook and Investigations for the Missing on Instagram.
Because forever is too long to wait.